Hello.
Hello and welcome everyone. Good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you are. We would like to welcome you to the Trusted Exchange Framework Task Force of the Health Information Technology Advisory Committee. The meeting today will be led by our co-chairs, Arian Melik and Denise Webb. I will start the meeting with an official roll call. Arian Melik?
I'm here.
Denise Webb.
Here.
Carolyn Peterson. I'm sorry, Carolyn. You may have to circle back. Aaron Meary. John Kansky.
I'm here.
Cheryl Turney.
Here.
Sasha Termat.
Hello.
Steve Reedy. Steve Reedy, Cynthia Fisher, Anil Jain, Kate Goodrich, David McCallie.
Here.
Thank you. Mark Savage. Mark. Noam Arts.
I'm here. Good morning.
Hello. And Grace Terrell.
Here.
Okay, thank you. Just a reminder to everyone, we will do brief introductions of all of the task force members here shortly. Since this is a virtual meeting, for those task force members, if you'd like to ask a question or a comment in the upper panel near the left center, you are asked to raise your hand using the hand raise icon. And one of the chairs or myself will call on you for comment. And so with that, I will turn it over to Arian Melik and Denise Webb.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Trusted Exchange Framework Task Force. This is one of those items where we are being tasked by the Health IT Advisory Committee to provide recommendations to ONC, first through the HITAC, and then ultimately to ONC on the Trusted Exchange Framework. As I think everybody recognizes, the Trusted Exchange Framework was called out by Congress in 21st Century Cures as a key component of ONC's mission to enable broader information exchange and mitigate perceptions of information blocking from both provider organizations and health IT vendors. We have a pretty steep work plan ahead of us. So even though it's not Christmas, the mantra of Office of No Christmas still applies. We've got every 2 meetings a week through a marathon. We get 1 week where we only have 1 meeting a week where we'll draft up some recommendations. And then we'll go back to 2 a week in order to finalize the recommendations. But this is a really important activity because the work that we're doing will lay the groundwork for ONC's adoption and implementation of the Trusted Exchange Framework for the nation. And the work that we do right now is incredibly impactful on the future of the health information exchange ecosystem and the future of healthcare and health delivery in this country. I think we've got a very talented and engaged task force, and I look forward to the long and grueling hours that we will put into doing this work. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Denise for additional comments.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Arian. I want to thank all of you for contributing your time to work with Arian and I on this important work. I've been involved in this world of health information exchange for several years, and I'm looking forward to us making marked progress in the next years to come with this work that we're doing on the Trusted Exchange framework. So we have the opportunity to shape what comes out and make recommendations to the committee and eventually to the ONC. And so I look forward to working with all of you. And again, I thank you for your time and your commitment to this.
Why don't we do a brief round of introductions, and if you could just state your name and the organization that you work for. No need for lengthy comments. Or
Arian, we've lost you.
Arian, let's try it this way. There we go. So why don't we go maybe have Lauren walk us through a round of introductions. If you could just state what your name is, the organization you represent. No need for lengthy introductions or bios. We have a ton of work to do today and a ton of work to do over the next short amount of time. So we'd appreciate if you could just keep the hellos to the minimum, and just so we can recognize people's voices on the phone.
Okay, and why don't we start with Carolyn, and then we can follow the order that's on the screen.
Yes, this is Carolyn Peterson. In my day job, I work for Mayo Clinic, but I'm actually on the committee as an independent patient advocate, being a 35-year cancer survivor.
And I believe Aaron is absent. John?
Yeah, I'm John Kansky with the Indiana Health Information Exchange.
Great. Cheryl?
I'm Cheryl Turney, and I'm with Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Thank you. Sasha?
Hello, this is Sasha Termott with EPIC and the Electronic Health Records Association.
Great. And just checking again, has Steve Reedy joined? No? Okay. And has Cynthia Fisher joined? Not yet. Anil Jain? So I see Anil is on the Adobe, but maybe we'll circle back. Kate Goodrich? David McCauley?
Hi. Good afternoon. David McCauley. I'm Senior Vice President at Cerner. I've been there for 25 years.
Thank you. Mark Savage?
Hi, Mark Savage. I'm at UC San Francisco's Center for Digital Health Innovation.
And some of you may know Mark for his much more famous wife, so just want to point out that Mark has some connection to ONC through Lucy Savage, who used to be a Chief Privacy Officer for ONC.
Yeah,
always glad to give a twofer.
And Noam Arts?
Hi, and Noam Arts, and I'm the president of HLN Consulting.
Okay, and Grace Terrell.
Hi, it's Grace Terrell. I am the CEO of Envision Genomics, which is a precision medicine company, as well as a practice and general internist at part of the Wake Forest Baptist Health System.
Great. All right, I will turn this now over to Denise or Aaron.
Again, just welcome everybody, and thanks for your participation. Thanks for your time, and we're going to be asking a lot of you over the next month. Why don't we go over? I think let's go to the agenda. To the charge. So our goal as a task force is to provide comment on the draft trusted exchange framework that ONC has put out. In particular, make recommendations on Part A and Part B, and in particular, for people who've read the Trusted Exchange Framework, Part B is really the substantive. Part A really sets out the policy goals, and Part B sets out much of the substantive mechanics. So we're going to be doing a fair amount of work on Part B, in particular commenting on the recommendations relative to the RCE. And in particular, the eligibility requirements for the RCE, recommendations for the eligibility requirements for the QHIN, recommendations relative to permitted purposes and disclosures, and recommendations relative to privacy and security. If there are other topics that we want to get into, I think we can add those. We just need to make sure that we're getting through these as well. There's a little bit of a some of us have been through a bunch of this stuff before, there's a little bit of a danger to going super detailed and just following the logic of the recommendations I would encourage people, if they have higher order comments or higher order activities that we might want to put comment on or get to agreement on, we should add those to the agenda. But again, just subject to the notion that we need to get through these four key charges. I'm going to pause and just see if there's any questions relative to the charges that we're being asked to get through.
Arian, it's David. Go ahead.
So surprised to hear you make some comments.
No, I have a question for you. Actually, are there parallel work groups or task forces addressing other aspects that we should either be prepared to sort of stay away from, or I don't know what else is being done.
There's another. It's a great question, and I was gonna jump in and acknowledge that the time clock for public comment for the TEF has, I think, expired or just about to expire, and acknowledge that ONC has given this task force a somewhat wider, a longer time clock to make recommendations, acknowledging that the HITAC was took a little while to get up and running. I'd acknowledge, number two, that in my experience, really good substantive recommendations from the task force have historically held a lot of weight with ONC, because we can be, in some cases, more thoughtful and represent a wider range of interest than the broad set of public comment. But I'd also say that ONC is free to disregard our comment and is going to be looking at the balance of both the public comment and our comment. And then number three is there's a parallel task force to go over the USCDS. I think I've got that right. What do we call it these days?
USCDI, the U.S. Core Data for Interoperability.
Thank you. So there's a parallel task force to go over the USCDI, and we should, unless we think we have something really, really important to say, we should let that task force do their job relative to USCDI and confine our comments primarily to the TEF.
Thanks.
Yep. Other questions on the charge? Yeah.
This is Cynthia Fisher. The call center had me on mute. I don't know if you knew I was on the call, so I just dialed back in. Yes, I've been on the call. Thanks.
So, Arian, I think Zoe is going to launch into her presentation.
Perfect.
And then we can let her get through her presentation and see if there's any questions from the task force members after that.
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you guys so much. Yes, so my name is Zoe Barber, and I am the ONC staff lead for the Trusted Exchange Framework Task Force. I'm also a special assistant to Principal Deputy National Coordinator Genevieve Morris, and have been working closely with her over the past year to develop the draft document that we're going to be discussing today. So as Arian mentioned a second ago, as you all know, we're here to develop and advance recommendations on the Trusted Exchange Framework, and we're going to be looking specifically at four main topic areas: the RCE, the qualified HINs, permitted uses and disclosures, and privacy and security. And so I'm going to go into more detail on all of these four areas and talk a little bit about the areas in the document that align to these four themes. Okay, so what is the Draft Trusted Exchange Framework? Next slide. So as many of you know, the language in 21st century CHERS tells us to either develop or support a draft Trusted Exchange Framework and a common agreement. And so what we have released on January 5th was just the Trusted Exchange Framework, and that is what we're going to be providing our recommendations on. We then plan to work with an external entity, a recognized coordinating entity, which we're going to talk about in more detail in a few minutes, to develop the final Trusted Exchange Framework, including the Common Agreement, which will be published in the Federal Register by the end of the year. So the draft framework is divided into two sections. The first is Part A, which are the principles for Trusted Exchange. These are the overarching principles and guidelines, the rules of the road, if you will, for engendering trust among health information networks nationally. They're divided into six principles that also align to some of the terms and conditions in Part B. The first principle is standardization, and this is really referring to adhering to federally and industry-recognized standards And in Part B, we've included a number of requirements around how health qualified health information networks must connect to each other, including requirements around use of a connectivity broker and having the ability to exchange all of the data in the US CDI. The second principle is around transparency. This refers to the need to conduct all exchange openly and transparently. Principle three is cooperation and non-discrimination. This really refers to the fact that we don't want any organizations limiting the exchange of data to another organization based on competitive purposes. We've included a number of provisions within Part B to address that. The next principle is security and patient safety. Again, we have a number of privacy and security provisions in Part B, and we're going to be getting into more detailed discussions about that over the course of the next month. The next principle is access, and this really refers to the ability for a patient and their caregiver to be able to access their own data regardless of where they went for care or even if they remember the doctor that they saw. And we've addressed this in a number of ways in Part B, including in the inclusion of the individual access permitted purpose. And then finally, the last principle is data-driven accountability. And this is a goal that really came out of 21st Century Cures, focusing around the ability for a provider to query for multiple patients, for multiple patient records at one time in a single transaction and thus, you know, to support population health level type services. So the next section is Part B, and these are the minimum required terms and conditions for trusted exchange. So these are the actual legal contractual language that we're going to be working to incorporate into the final common agreement that we develop with the recognized coordinating entity. It's important to note that Part B is not a full end-to-end agreement, and it focuses on the variation or the divergence across some of the health information networks that are operating today that are currently inhibiting the flow of information. ONC gathered input from a number of stakeholders, and we really came up with, or we heard from them where the gaps were in the market, where we really needed to set some standards and rules for allowing data to be exchanged. Next slide. Okay, so briefly, I'm going to go through the five goals of the Trusted Exchange Framework. So goal one is to build on and extend existing work done in the industry. And so again, we felt that it was important to, you know, we felt that there was a lot of, there's a lot of work being done in the industry now around doing participation agreements and this kind of exchange. And we felt, you know, we didn't want to trounce on the good work that was being done, but rather fill in the gaps where things haven't been working. And so again, we met with a number of stakeholders, and what we really tried to do is hit the right balance between not being too prescriptive, but still minimizing some of that variation that prohibits data from flowing today. Goal two is to provide a single on-ramp to interoperability for all. Here, we're talking really about allowing all types of providers to sign on to any health information network of their choice and receive all the information on a patient, regardless of where that patient went for care. We heard from multiple stakeholders that currently they are forced to enter into multiple point-to-point agreements or connect to multiple point-to-point interfaces that can be extremely costly and complex in order for them to access all of the data that needs to be exchanged. And so it's our goal to provide a way for everyone to connect once to the exchange network of their choice, and then that becomes a gateway to all of the other networks that may have information pertinent to the care of that individual or population. Goal three is to be scalable to support the entire nation. So again, having a system that can be used regardless of what kind of healthcare stakeholder you are and where you are located. Goal four is to build a competitive marketplace allowing all to compete on data services. So this really gets to the need to transition the marketplace from competing on the actual exchange of data and data hoarding to competing on the actual value-add services that can be performed on top of the data itself. So we believe that by easing the flow of information across the market will allow for some new innovative technologies to enter the marketplace, including maybe things like apps that will allow data to be accessed by patients at their fingertips. And then finally, goal five, achieving long-term sustainability. Again, we believe that this framework, by laying out some of the base requirements for exchanging data. We're allowing for variation on a broader set of use cases. This will promote long-term sustainability. Next slide, please. These are some of the stakeholders that can use the Trusted Exchange Framework. We try to structure the framework in a way that would be as inclusive as possible and allow all different types of healthcare stakeholders across the continuum to participate. So here you'll see we've included health information networks that also include health information exchanges, public health, payers, technology developers, providers, individuals, again, going back to that individual access use case, and, of course, federal agencies. And we had a number of meetings with our federal partners as well to make sure that the terms and conditions in the TEFCA are working for them and enabling them to exchange data as well. Next slide, please. Okay, so how will the Trusted Exchange Framework work? Next slide. So I'm going to talk a little bit now about our first two, the first two themes that we're going to cover, which are the RCE and the qualified HINs, and this is just a brief snapshot of what the entire structure will look like, and now we're going to break down each of these components. So if you go to the next slide, so first we're going to discuss the recognized coordinating entity. So this really goes back to that language in the Cures Act that ONC either develop or support a trusted exchange framework. And we feel like there are a number of existing entities today that have already been doing a lot of work similar to this and that they are well positioned to act as this external entity to operationalize the framework and to, to act as the governance and enforcement body who can provide day-to-day oversight, management, and enforcement of the qualified HINs. ONC plans to work collaboratively with the RCE via a cooperative agreement to develop that full common agreement and then also or to develop the full common agreement that qualified HINs will have to adopt, and then also to continuously update the framework as needed, with new technologies or new use cases, and stay involved in the implementation of the TEFCA throughout the cooperative agreement. So if you go to the next slide, here are some details on our plans for awarding this entity. So we're planning on releasing this funding opportunity for a single, so that's one single entity to be the RCE, and it will be a multi-year cooperative agreement. We're hoping to release this by April and then award an organization by August. And then ideally, we'll hit the ground running and develop and finalize that common agreement so that it can be published by the end of the year. So our first discussion on Friday is really going to center around some of the requirements for the RCE, specifically talking about some of the eligibility requirements, what their roles and responsibilities might be in relation to, working with ONC and also monitoring the qualified HINs, what kinds of metrics and milestones are we going to want to use to measure the success of the RCE and also of the qualified HINs, and some things to think about in regards to the RC, is that due to the tight turnaround on the timeline for the cooperative agreement, and also based on our goal for kind of building off existing work done in the marketplace, we're really looking for an organization that has existing experience building multi-stakeholder collaborations. Maybe this is somebody who's currently operating across state lines and has a nationwide footprint already, possibly an entity that already has in place a multi-stakeholder board or, even legal counsel such that they can, when they're awarded in August, will really be able to hit the ground running and get started writing the cooperative or get started writing the common agreement. Next slide, please. Okay, so next I'm going to talk about the qualified health information networks. So this saying that the Trusted Exchange Framework aims to create a technical and governance infrastructure that connects health information networks through a core of qualified health information networks. So if you go to the next slide, here we have a definition of a health information network. I'm not going to read this. This definition is in your materials. You guys can take a look at it on your own. But if you go to the next slide, These are the details for what a qualified health information network must be. And the qualified health information networks are a subset of that larger population of health information networks, and so they have to meet these additional capabilities that need to be supported on top of what a health information network has to have. And our intention here is to really have a small number of qualified PINs that are connecting directly to each other and can act as a gateway or facilitators of exchange for the rest of their exchange participants. So in order to be a qualified HIN, again, you have to meet all the requirements of a HIN, but additionally, you should be able to locate and transmit PHI between multiple persons or entities electronically, have mechanisms in place to impose the minimum core obligations, and to audit participants' compliance. And then you have to have and control what's called a connectivity broker service. We're going to be discussing the capabilities and requirements around this connectivity broker service more. But essentially, QHINs will be connecting to each other through this service, which would include the ability to send and receive broadcast and directed queries through a master patient index and a record locator service. They would also be responsible for returning data to a requesting qualified HIN from across all of the QHINs, participants, and end users in a single transaction. So the key here is that the qualified HIN must be able to support that broadcast query use case. And we believe that in order to do that and in order to promote scalability, you're going to need a kind of small number of these qualified HIN connection points at the top. The next area of this definition that we're going to be looking at is the participant neutral requirement. And currently in the draft document, we talk about participant neutral in that none of the exchanges of electronic health information by or on behalf of the qualified HIN can actually include the qualified HIN itself as one of the parties exchanging data. And again, the overall goal here is to keep the total number of qualified HINs small in order to best promote that broadcast query use case and to promote scalability. And so when we're looking at these two definitions with the connectivity broker service and the participant neutral requirement, we're going to want to make sure that we're hitting the right chord here and that these definitions are getting to our intended goal of having that small number of qualified HINs that can connect to each other and support broadcast queries. Next slide, please. So I'm going to talk a little bit here about the structure of a qualified health information network. So here you can kind of see how you have your qualified HIN sort of at the top here, and they connect to other qualified HINs via their connectivity broker. And then within the qualified HIN, they have their own participants and end users. And so a good example of how this might work would say, let's say we have a qualified health information network that's made up of a number of health IT developers. And so maybe that includes an EHR vendor, a population health or analytics vendor, and maybe even a consumer app or patient portal app. So then in that case, some of the end users would be maybe an individual provider or hospital or even an individual consumer who's maybe using that patient portal app. And so the way the exchange of data would work is that the end user, in this example, the consumer, would query their vendor for information. And then that participant, or that vendor, would query the qualified HIN. The qualified HIN would then send a broadcast query to all of the other qualified HINs using their connectivity broker service and the standards that are enumerated in the TEFCA. And then the qualified HINs would then query their own participants and their own end users using whatever their agreed upon internal standards are to see if they have the information. The qualified HIN would then send a note back to the initiating qualified HIN saying either, yes, we do have your data, or no, we don't have any data. And then the initiating qualified HIN would say, okay, please send me the data. And then the responding qualified HIN would have to consolidate all of the data from all of their participants and end users and send that response back to the initiating qualified HIN in a single transaction. At that point, the initiating qualified hang can then send that data back down to their participants and end users using whatever the agreed upon standards and policies and procedures that they have within the qualified hang. So something to note here is that we really tried to not specify any of the internal infrastructure or technology requirements of the qualified HIMs themselves. We're trying to leave open enough flexibility for the QHINs to develop their own business models, and allow for them to kind of perform the value-add services and serve the stakeholders that they want to directly serve. But at the same time, the qualified HINs will be responsible for responding to all six of the permitted purposes. Next slide, please. Okay, so just bringing it all back together again, you'll see we have that RCE umbrella organization at the top who's performing that oversight and governance for the QHINs. QHINs are connecting directly to each other through that connectivity broker service and through standards that we've specifically laid out in the Trusted Exchange Framework. And then you see how they're passing that data back down to their participants and their end users. Next slide, please. Okay, so next we're going to talk about some of the use cases that are covered under the Trusted Exchange Framework and the permitted purposes. So if you go to the next slide. So you'll see here some of the usual suspects are treatment, payment, and healthcare operations as defined in HIPAA. But we've also included permitted purposes here for public health, benefits determination, and individual access. And I'll just note that the benefits determination permitted purpose is specifically for non-healthcare related benefits. This is something that after conversations with our federal partners, including the Social Security Administration, we added this permitted purpose specifically to serve their populations for when they have to make Social Security or disability benefits. We've received some comments that the public health use case may not be fleshed out enough, and so we're definitely looking to see what other requirements we might have to put in to flesh out that use case further. And then, of course, on the individual access use case, we really want to make sure that we're hitting the goal and the intent of the 21st Century Cures Act through that use case. Next slide, please. So the three use cases that we've laid out in the Trusted Exchange Framework are broadcast query, directed query, and population level data. One thing to note here is that qualified HINs are welcome to have other agreements with other qualified HINs and other organizations for use cases outside of these three use cases. As long as they're not conflicting with the terms of the TEFCA, we've said that there's really no limitation on agreements that you can have on top of these use cases. So the first use case is this broadcast query use case, and this goes back to what we were talking about with the connectivity broker service. And this is the ability to be able to request data on a patient from multiple endpoints without, in a single query without knowing where the data resides. So it supports situations where you don't know where you're pulling that data from. And this is particularly important for the individual access use case because, as a patient or even as a caregiver, I may not remember who all my doctors are, and I certainly may not remember where they're all located, especially if I travel around and move a lot. And so having the option of being able to do a broadcast query where I can pull data from across the continuum using a single network and have a return to me no matter where I went for care is going to be really important for my ability to engage in my own care and also to act as a caregiver to my family members. The directed query use case, this is something that is probably familiar to all of us, support situations where you do know where the specific health information resides. And then finally, the population level data use case. And this is something, really a future use case. It's something that's still in development. But ideally, this would allow, for a patient representative to query for all patients in a panel at the same time rather than having to go out and request each record individually. And this will support, population health services, quality measurement, risk analysis, et cetera. So some questions that we may want to consider when we're discussing the use cases and the permitted purposes are, again, you know, some ways to further flesh out that public health and individual access permitted purposes, you know, making sure that we're getting the, we're striking the right note with the broadcast query and the capabilities around that. And, you know, are there ways to support additional permitted purposes or use cases that maybe we didn't include, such as research, for example? Next slide, please. Okay, so the U.S. core data for interoperability, so as Arian mentioned at the beginning of the call, we are not directly going to be talking about the U.S. CDI. There is another task force group that is going to be focused solely on the U.S. CDI. However, we will be getting into it a little bit, you know, just in the way that it affects some of the other topic areas that we're going to be focused on. So specifically, how the some of the mandatory updating of the US CDI may affect the qualified HIMSS. Next slide, please. Okay, and finally, our last topic area is privacy and security. Next slide. So we worked very closely in collaboration with NIST, which was something that was mandated in the 21st Century Cures Act, to make sure that we were setting a minimum bar for ID proofing and for authentication. A major issue that we've heard from the industry is that not everyone is identity proofing consumers to the same level. Some are setting the bar too high, and others are setting the bar too low, and this is inhibiting data exchange. And so what we tried to do, and in our conversations with NIST, was we really tried to set a minimum ground of ID proofing to where people can be comfortable treating the patient, but also not setting the bar too high so that no one can meet the requirements. And so we've set the bar here at the new IAL2 requirements. These are the new NIST NIST requirements that have been transitioned from the old level of assurance standards. And we're going to be hitting IAL2 for both end users and participants. If you go to the next slide, we are aware that this that IAL2 might be a somewhat high bar for individuals, and so we've added a couple of exceptions specifically for individuals to, you know, hopefully allow for them to be able to meet the identity proofing requirements without too much burden. So the first is we've enabled, or we're allowing for like practice staff, for example, to act as a trusted referee and authoritative source. So this is where they can use personal knowledge of the individual to enroll a patient. And the other exception is an antecedent event. So staff may also act as an authoritative source and use other identification that was maybe collected during an antecedent or prior event to verify the identity of the patient. So we are heavily monitoring some of the industry initiatives that are out there right now, like the Care and Health Alliance, to see what they're going to come up with around ID proofing and consent, and we're hopeful that as we get towards the final, that we're going to be able to that there will be some new policies and standards that we can bake in that might make this even easier. And we're very much looking for feedback from you guys also on how we can make the ID proofing easier for patients, so that we're not creating a barrier. Next slide. And I think this is the last slide. So similarly to the identity proofing requirements, we've also set requirements for authentication, again, using the new NIST standards. And specifically, we've set the requirement at AAL2 with requirement for support of FAL2 or FAL3. And to note that a qualified HIN would require two-factor authentication for this use case. Next slide. I think that's the end of the slides. Perfect. Okay, so we're going to be going through each of those topic areas. As you can see here, we have a pretty tight schedule. And Arian, I don't know if you want me to hand it back to you to go through the work plan in more detail.
No, why don't you go through the work plan, and then we can do the follow-up questions.
Okay, perfect. So on our meeting on February 23rd, which is this Friday, as I mentioned, we're going to start getting into some of those questions about the recognized coordinating entity, their eligibility requirements, what milestones they might want to hit over the course of the three-year period, maybe what some of the metrics and milestones that should be for measuring their success and measuring compliance with the TEFCA. And then on Monday, the 26th, we're going to get into the requirements and definitions of a qualified health information network. So again, getting into that connectivity broker service, the definition of participant neutral, the definition of a connectivity broker, and some of the requirements that we have around qualified HINs having to share their fee schedules and share their participation agreements. March 2nd. We will get into our discussion on permitted uses and disclosures. So again, going through the six permitted uses and the three use cases that we've discussed. And then on March 5th, we'll be hitting our topic area of privacy and security and going into more detail there. And then at that time, we will also begin drafting recommendations and spend that week beginning March 5th drafting recommendations. We won't have a meeting on March 9th. And then starting March 12th, we will be reviewing those recommendations, finalizing those recommendations, and then ideally sending the final recommendations to the full committee on the 19th and presenting on the 21st. So pretty tight schedule, but I have faith that we can get everything done.
As an editorial for folks who've been through task force approaches before, this is incredibly ambitious. And will require a huge amount of work, probably both work on the meetings as well as work offline. But because of the time urgency of this and because of the need for ONC to be able to respond to our recommendations and incorporate them into the next iteration, the final iteration of the test, it would be we really need to adhere to this schedule. So apologize in advance for the sort of death march approach, but I'm confident that with this group we can get through it.
Arian, it's Mark. Can I ask a quick question?
Please.
Just to check to make sure that folks in designing the work plan reflected that March 5th through 9th is HIMSS.
Yes, right. Well, that's one of the reasons that we did a no meeting on March 9th. March 5th, if folks could it's a good consideration. We might want to consider doubling up on the 2nd if we find that we can't have a large number of people on the 5th. I'd ask if we can stick to this work plan. That would be great. But if we have a large number of people who just will be out of pocket on the 5th, then we might need to find additional time on the week of the 26th to go through the privacy and security recommendations. We are going to need some time to draft recommendations, and I think for anybody who's been through this before, you think you've captured what you thought through until it comes time to draft the final recommendations, and then you realize that there's a lot more ambiguity than the discussion really got through. So I think it's important to have a good long time to go through the draft recommendations and get them tightened up. So yeah, it's not ideal from a timing consideration. And if we need to double up on the 2nd or find some more time on that week, I think we'd all be open to doing that. But it would be ideal if we could stick to this plan.
And any chance of finding a room at HIMSS on the 5th for those of us who might be there? I mean, perhaps we can do the best of both worlds.
Interesting idea.
That's a good suggestion for the attendees at HIMSS. And you know, that is the first day, so there's the pre-conference workshops that day. I'm hoping that folks can make themselves available. I'm actually going to be in Mexico, but we'll call in.
Arian, this is John Kansky. I'm currently on the HIMSS board, so if you need somebody to score a room on the 5th, let me know.
That would be awesome. If you could do that, I think that would be incredibly useful.
But it needs to be a room with dial-out, because
yeah.
we want to be fair to those who are not in the room.
which I won't be.
Sure. If I could get the folks to respond with how many or anybody give me feedback on how many people we expect to be on site, so I know how big of a room with a phone I need.
Just to keep things sensible for you, why don't we send that information to Lauren and then have Lauren consolidate it and then send it to you? Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, I think we have 5 more minutes before we go to public comment and close out the meeting. So broad questions about the charge, remit, or work plan?
So this is Cheryl. Sorry.
Oh, please go ahead.
This is Cheryl Cheney. I have a question. It's because of the way this advises ONC, is there going to be any then advisement that goes back to Congress? I mean, would we see any mandates coming out of this? I'm asking because it does seem that for some of the qualified HIN standards and requirements, it might be beneficial to mandate some aspects of this. Is that within the realm of recommendations that we have?
Yeah, our charge is to the to the national coordinator. So the HIT Advisory Committee advises the national coordinator. I think it's appropriate if we find it compelling enough to recommend that the national coordinator follow up with Congress and consider making recommendations. But I think that's outside of our charge relative to what our goal is. Lauren, do you have any comments there?
No, Arianne, I think you captured it. I would just clarify that after or within our recommendations to the national coordinator, but we could also recommend that they be escalated to the Secretary of HHS.
And then as an editorial comment, I'd say that Congress mandating standards in law is probably a bad idea. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, so this is Sasha. I just have a logistical question. Given the scope of our work and the expectation that some of it will happen not during our meetings, what's the best way for us to be communicating and working in a synchronized fashion not during these calls? Will we have specific assignments, processes for capturing feedback offline?
I'm going to defer to Lauren on this. I've done in the past small sub-work groups in order to keep things on pace. So I'd say as we discover areas where a subgroup wants to go off and do some additional work, I definitely encourage that. And then typically the least common denominator here is sending Word documents via email, which for those of us used to more collaborative tools is somewhat unsatisfying. I don't know, Lauren, if we have if our contract facilitator has any additional tools that are at our disposal.
We can take that offline to see what collaborative tools we have online for the group, but you are correct in that we can certainly kind of establish sub-work groups of the task force. And then we can also, you know, just set up, and so I don't know if you have set up already, just an email distribution for the group as well. For quick communication, but we can follow up on official collaborative platforms.
Lauren, it would be helpful if we could just send around a list of committee members to the committee members, a list of committee members, key staff, and associated email addresses so that we can use that as a handy reference for doing email-based communication. But it would be nice if there were more, group chat like, or I won't use the S word, but similar tools that that allow us to do social collaboration. Those kinds of tools can be really useful in working through things like this, as well as can wikis.
Yep,
I think
in task forces in the past we've used Google Docs. I'm not sure that's approved or not, but that's
I think we just did it sort of ad hoc, and we didn't ask anybody, which is a useful way to go.
Yep. And we can circle back with our IT team just to make sure that we have the appropriate parameters on our end set in place.
And Lauren will keep us honest relative to our obligations under the FACA rules.
Absolutely. So I have just about 9 minutes before 3. Are there any other last-minute questions or comments before we go to the public comment period? Okay, hearing none. Operator, can you please open the line for public comments?
Certainly. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question at this time, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate that your line is in the question queue, and you may press *2 if you'd like to remove your question from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. Again, that is *1 to ask a question at this time. And we'll hold for just a few moments to see if there are any questions.
Thank you.
Again, that is *1 to ask a question at this time. It seems that we have no questions over the phone.
Okay, thank you. So with a few minutes left, Arian and Denise, I'll hand it back to you to see if there are any other, if you would like to utilize the last 8 minutes or so, or Zoe, if you have any other comments or questions.
Yeah, Denise, over to you.
So I think it would be helpful if Zoe could indicate to the members of the task force what the process will be for the next couple of meetings and what they can expect to see in preparation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Denise, you mean Ariane might want to talk about this in a little bit more detail, specifically how we're going to go through the discussions. But I think for the meeting on Friday with the recognized coordinating entity, we'll draft a bunch of various discussion questions that we can go through. And I would encourage folks to take a look at the requirements for the RCE, and that's in Part A, or actually it's before Part A, of the draft document under the section How Will It Work, that has a kind of lengthy description there for the RCE. And then for the following meetings, again, encouraging folks to look at the portions of the draft document that align with the topic that we're going to be discussing that day. And we've included a draft of the full document in your materials also, if you need any help finding anything.
One other thing I think that would be useful to do is to review the actual 21st Century Cures legislative text. And I want to acknowledge that in some cases, for example, permitted uses and disclosures will be in a somewhat odd area where I think people who followed me on Twitter will recognize that I've been somewhat obsessed about what Congress actually intended in some of their language. On these topics, but I think it's useful to ground our work in what the legislative text actually says, because in some cases in the past, I know that folks have been critical of ONC for going in direction X versus direction Y, not to recognize that actually direction X was mandated by Congress, and then secondly, to acknowledge that we're going to get into some areas where there'll be additional clarification that will come out via rulemaking, via the NPRM that I believe was slated for April, at least tentatively on the OMB work plan. And in those areas, we're going to have to do our best recognizing that in some areas there may be additional work that's going on at ONC relative to rulemaking that'll clarify what we're doing.
Great. Thanks, Arianna. That's certainly a good point. And for the members, we can get you copies of that legislation if you don't have it readily available.
Yeah, maybe some excerpted copies that are relevant for the TEFCA and permitted purposes.
Sure.
That would be very helpful.
This is Grace Terrell. I just had another question as you all were talking, and that is, it appears I'm going to be missing one meeting. It happens to be the one on Friday, first previously scheduled things. Is there going to be the possibility of actually having access to the to the material of a meeting that we missed, you know, as I'm looking here, watching the dialogue be typed, how can we do that in a way so that we're able to keep up with pieces of the dialogue that we may unnecessarily miss?
Sure. So this is Lauren. The both the meeting transcript and the meeting summary will be available on healthit.gov, and we can send you the specific list under the FACA, full FACA schedule, if you will. So shortly after the meeting, the transcripts will be there, and then a few days after that, the meeting summary.
And then as we have draft recommendations, we will send those draft recommendations to the full task force. So even if you miss a session and you've got some comment, being able to provide editorial comments or other or others on the recommendations will be a second pass at that topic. So rest assured, you won't have just one pass. You can have multiple. And if you do miss a meeting, I'd encourage people to send their thoughts pre-meeting if there's particular topics of concern or particular questions that you want to ask. It's a useful practice to be able to send those pre-meeting, and we'll make sure that we get them discussed during the meeting itself.
Thank you for saying that, Arian. I was just going to suggest that to Grace, since she can't be with us Friday. If she has input, we definitely want to get everybody's input.
Absolutely.
Okay. Any other last comments or questions?
This will be the easiest meeting in the sequence. It only gets harder from there.
Get ready to roll up your sleeves.
Okay. All right. Well, I'd like to thank everyone for their time today, and we will adjourn now.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Yeah.